Today marks the 200th anniversary of the publication of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, one of the most famous novels in English. Book critic Maureen Corrigan joins with multitudes who say attention must be paid.
My favorite item from the growing mountain of Pride and Prejudice bicentennial trivia comes courtesy of an article in something called Regency World magazine, which is going gaga over the anniversary. The article, headlined Albert Goes Ape for Austen, describes how a 200-pound orangutan named Albert, living in the Gdansk Zoo in Poland, insists on having 50 pages a night of Pride and Prejudice read to him at bedtime by his keeper, or else he refuses to go to sleep. What does Albert the orangutan hear in Pride and Prejudice, I wonder? Maybe the same thing my students hear when I teach survey courses on the evolution of the novel. We start our voyage out with Robinson Crusoe and often go on to Samuel Richardson's Pamela and Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, fine, weird novels that seem to hail from a civilization a million light years from our own. Then we arrive home on planet Austen. The relief in the classroom is palpable. The energy of class discussion spikes. It's certainly not that my students mistake Austen's world for our own. After all, her novels revolve around the make-or-break perils of a highly ritualized marriage market. Rather, it's Austen's smart girl voice, peppery, wry, eye-rolling, that seems so close to modern consciousness. Austen could be gal pals with Tina Fey and Lena Dunham. She talks to us directly, bridging time and custom. Pride and Prejudice, Austen's most widely read novel, was first published on January 28, 1813, 200 years ago today, and has since generated musicals and computer games, operas and anime, Masterpiece Theater costume dramas, and Bollywood movies. It's been updated and reimagined as mystery fiction, sci-fi, X-rated erotica, and vampire gore. We readers clearly want Austen's voice to go on and on, a voice that was silenced when she died at the age of 41 in 1817. Though I could happily watch Bridget Jones's Diary for eternity, I mostly think the best way to revisit Austen and learn something new is through the art of criticism. Out of the slew of critical books that have been spawned by this Pride and Prejudice bicentennial, one that particularly caught my eye is called The Real Jane Austen by Paula Byrne. Byrne has previously written about Austen and the theater. Here, she takes a clever approach to scrutinizing the few facts that we know about Austen's life. Byrne reads Austen's life through key objects, many of which would have surrounded her in her parlor and bedroom. There are familiar relics like the three vellum notebooks in which a juvenile Austen penned poems and stories, as well as the pair of gorgeous topaz crosses that Austen's sailor brother Charles bought for Jane and her sister Cassandra. Then there are more exotic tokens. An East Indian shawl belonged to Austen's Aunt Philadelphia, who sailed to India with other single girls in search of husbands. They were part of what was then derisively called the fishing fleet. Byrne's aim is to show how these objects, many of them reproduced in her book in lush color plates, reveal a much more cosmopolitan awareness of the world than is commonly credited to Austen. Byrne also throws in a wild card, a small Regency-era portrait sketch of a slim middle-aged woman, cap on head, pen in hand. The portrait's provenance is unknown. On its back, someone wrote, Miss Jane Austen, spelling the last name with an I, as Austen herself did on her 1816 royalty check for her novel Emma. If this is indeed an authentic portrait of Austen, she looks like you might want her to look, staring off into the distance, faintly smiling. Perhaps getting a kick out of a vision of the great fuss futurity would make of the creatures of her imagination.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can read an excerpt of Paula Byrne's book, The Real Jane Austen, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of the show. You can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Reading used to be a private act, just you and your imagination immersed in another world. But now, if you curl up with an e-reader, you're not alone. Data is being collected about your reading habits, and that information belongs to the companies who sell e-readers, like Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They can also share or sell that information. One Barnes & Noble official has said that sharing data with publishers might help authors create even better books. Well, that got NPR's Lynn Neary wondering, what do novelists think of that idea?
People who buy electronic readers may think it's a great way to read a book, but they might not realize it's also a brilliant marketing tool. E-readers, says best-selling author Scott Turow, can glean a lot of information about their owners.
You can tell everything about how somebody reads a book, you know, whether they're the kind who skip to the end, how fast they read, what they skip. So, they can give the author specifically the feedback as, 35% of the people who bought this book quit after the first two chapters.
Turow, who is also president of the Authors Guild, says this kind of information can be very useful to a writer.
I mean, I would love to know if 35% of my readers were quitting after the first two chapters, because that, frankly, strikes me as sometimes a problem I could fix. But yeah, would I love to be able to hitch the equivalent of a polygraph to my readers and know how they're actually responding word by word? That would be quite interesting.
There's no question, says novelist Jonathan Evison, that writers are keenly interested in how readers respond to their work. But he says that doesn't mean a writer wants to tailor his work just to please the reader.
I'd be lying if I said I wasn't thinking about the reader all the time. I always think about the reader. You know, I'm trying to create an effect for the reader and sort of engage them in sort of a collaborative dance, I guess it is. But I'm still trying to be the leader.
The idea that data collected from e-readers might be used by publishers to improve a writer's work strikes Evison as wrong. It feels like creating by committee, he says, and reminds him of the days when he worked in commercial radio and met with general managers and program directors.
And they'd show me just thick packets of research that were all demographics. We did, you know, with focus groups, we did studies. These are the 100 songs we want you to play for your bumpers because these are the ones people like best. And this is what we want you to talk about. These are the sort of evergreen subjects that people like. People like topical. They would tell me all this. And what would happen is my show started to lose its voice.
What would have happened, says Evison, if this kind of research had been around when some of the world's greatest and most challenging books had been written? War and Peace, Ulysses, Moby Dick.
I mean, Moby Dick is one of my favorite books, but let's face it, it's a hot mess. You know what I mean? If I had a software that said, look, you know, maybe this 4-page, essay on Scrimshaw isn't going to fly with your 28 to 40 male demo, you know, what would we have lost with that? Sometimes, you know, it's got to be a little bit of a dictatorship.
There is nothing collaborative about writing a novel, says Scott Turow. It's one person's vision. On the other hand, he says, it makes sense for publishers to try to figure out what readers want. After all, publishers are trying to make money.
You know, there's a certain logic to that from the business side. Why should we publish this book if 11 readers out of 12 can't make it through page 36? But the 12th reader may be more discerning in her tastes, and you know, it could turn out that what people are thumbing their nose at is Ulysses or the novels of Faulkner.
Of course, there are different kinds of novels. Thoreau writes best-selling legal thrillers. Jennifer Egan writes literary fiction. In her book, A Visit from the Goon Squad, Egan played with the form of the novel. Although it was commercially successful and critically well-received, Egan knows for some readers, the novel just didn't work.
When I hear that someone couldn't connect with Goon Squad or found it too far out or couldn't get traction with it, I really do feel I failed that person. I don't at all subscribe to this idea that somehow they didn't quote-unquote get it, and I'm sorry about it. That being said, I think it is silly and kind of childish to expect to write a book like Goon Squad, which is kind of idiosyncratic, does not follow a lot of the narrative conventions we've come to expect from contemporary novels, is not straightforward. I think one can't do all that and then expect to be loved by everyone.
Egan suspects that information drawn from an e-book would show that a lot of readers skipped over one chapter in particular. It was written as a PowerPoint presentation.
While I respect the opinions of those who didn't connect with that PowerPoint chapter, and I really am sympathetic as someone who myself is kind of alienated by PowerPoint, I believe that chapter is the heart of the book. And I think without it, the experience of the book is not complete. And I say that, you know, knowing that many people were alienated by it. And I guess this speaks to the question of how important market research really would be for me as a, you know, as a creative person. Interesting to know, but should not necessarily be predictive or part of the creative process.
And anyway, Egan says she doubts Faulkner would have changed one word of Absalom Absalom on the basis of market research. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Next, let's get some movie and TV recommendations for our series Watch This. In his books for children, writer Neil Gaiman creates magical, often haunting worlds. His Newbery Award-winning The Graveyard Book is about a boy raised by ghosts.
Coraline is about a girl who discovers a mysterious door. And his latest book, Tuesday, is about a panda whose sneezes cause bad things to happen. Neil Gaiman's picks start with an episode of The Muppet Show, guest starring John Cleese.
The 1970s Muppet Show was one of the comedic glories of the human race. Being English, I always loved the 3 minutes of Muppet Show that we got that you never got, because an English television hour was 2.5, 3 minutes longer. And one of the things that they would do was these Muppet music hall numbers. And one of the things I loved best about that John Cleese episode is Miss Piggy singing the old English music hall song about being abandoned at the church.
Waiting at the church, when I found he left me in the lurch. Lord, how it did upset me.
And she has a pillow stuffed up her dress to make it appear that she is pregnant.
Yeah, like 9 months or whatever it is for a pig. Yeah, like right at the end.
Definitely ready to drop. Although she does make it clear at the end in badinage with Kermit that this is definitely just a pillow.
So this is pregnancy out of wedlock here, kind of racy for the Muppet Show.
And that was what I thought. And it's one of those glorious moments where I think they just thought, we can probably get away with this on English television. We couldn't get away with this on American television, but we will never show it on American television. And it's marvelous.
So you've included this Muppet episode that features John Cleese of Monty Python, of course. And you have also sent us one of the many movies of Monty Python's Terry Gilliam, a very talented director in addition to everything else that he's done. This movie is Time Bandits. What's it about?
Time Bandits is basically a film about a small boy who discovers that his bedroom is a hole leading to the rest of the universe, and as he is invaded by a number of dwarves escaping God with a map to everything.
Could happen to anybody.
As it could happen to anybody. It's a glorious feat of imagination, and I won't tell you what it's a quest for. It would give too much away.
There's more than one Terry Gilliam film that pushes these kinds of themes. You put a kid at the center of it. The kid is in jeopardy in one way or another, but going into a fantastic and amazing world.
I think Gilliam is always about pushing the bounds of imagination. Going into the imagination is almost like being a hunter. You can come back with magical, wonderful things that make your world better.
This is an Alice in Wonderland kind of story, which brings to mind that you have also sent us a Czech film from 1988 that is called Alice. And what is it?
Jan Švankmajer is a remarkable filmmaker. Alice was his interpretation of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. What I find fascinating about Alice is, on the one hand, it's profoundly nightmarish. As Jan Švankmajer animates, you have a live-action girl, mostly live-action, wandering through this story, but he's animating skulls, he's animating pieces of meat with nails in them. At one point, something that shouldn't be nightmarish but is, he starts animating socks filled with sawdust. They come out like weird sort of snakes or worms, and they're absolutely terrifying. But the film also, for whatever it says about my family, I brought it home on video the moment it came out, and my then 3-year-old daughter, It became her favorite film.
Oh.
And she would just watch Alice over and over again, and strangely enough, has not grown up to murder anybody.
We're getting close to some insight about adults and children and children's stories, because there is something beyond creepy, horrifying about it.
It is the stuff of pure nightmare.
But you're telling me you put a kid in front of that and the kid's like, yeah, I'm comfortable with this.
I think particularly in my daughter Holly's case, I forgot to mention to her that it was meant to be scary. And she just saw it as a wonderful animation of Lewis Carroll's Alice.
How do you deal with that when you're writing for kids, that sense of horror?
I trust them.
You trust the kids?
I trust the kids because kids are so much braver than adults sometimes, and so much less easily disturbed, which sounds ridiculous. Anybody who's had to calm a kid screaming at night down would laugh at me. But then you start talking to kids about what they're crying about, and you say, well, what was so upsetting? And they say, well, that commercial for the vacuum cleaner on TV, that vacuum cleaner came to life and it was after us. And you go, well, actually, kids will make their nightmares out of anything. The important thing, I think, in fiction, if you're giving them nightmares, is to demonstrate that nightmares are beatable.
Let me ask about one more thing. While we're talking about nightmares here, I'm delighted that you have included an episode of The Twilight Zone.
The episode is The After Hours. And it's just a classic Twilight Zone. And the ones that work just sit there in the back of your head, creeping you out and making the world a slightly more interesting place. And in the case of After Hours, Anne Francis is a runaway shop window dummy.
She starts out, she's a young woman, she's very pretty, she's very symmetrical. She's walking through the department store, and there's a ninth floor of the department store that no one seems to know about.
Miss Marshall White on the ninth floor. Specialties department, looking for a gold thimble. The odds are that she'll find it. But there are even better odds that she'll find something else. Because this isn't just a department store. This happens to be the Twilight Zone.
One of the things that I love most about this episode is that creeping feeling that the world is not the world that you think you're living in.
It becomes apparent that she is a department store mannequin who, according to some strange and unexplained arrangement, is allowed sometimes to become a real person, but then must return.
And of course, as a kid, and possibly even as an adult, I would eye department store mannequins and wonder if sometimes, when I took my eyes off them, they might have moved just a little.
Neil Gaiman, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
It has, very much so.
Neil Gaiman's new children's book is called Tuesday. He's part of our series Watch This. On Morning Edition from NPR News, I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Next, we'll recall a poet of the modern era who didn't seem modern at all.
Even when he was writing in the first half of the 20th century, the poetry of Robert Frost seemed a little old-fashioned. He rhymed in an age of free verse.
And in a time of mass urbanization and spreading technology, he set his poems in the New England countryside. Yet long after his death, which came 50 years ago today, the words of Robert Frost still resonate.
Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though.
We're listening to the Frost poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening.
He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year.
The poem goes on, the woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep.
Robert Frost was 88 when he passed away in Boston in 1963, after a lifetime of writing that earned him 4 Pulitzer Prizes for poetry. This week, a collection of his letters, photos, and recordings is being made public for the first time. They're at the State University of New York at Buffalo.
This collection comes from Jonathan Reichert, a retired professor who was a young man met Robert Frost.
I wasn't afraid to talk to him, and he, I think, was very willing to engage with me, and I was very lucky in that way.
Robert Frost was a friend of the Reichert family and sometimes shared his thoughts with the much younger man.
He was always wrestling with big ideas. And what was interesting is later on you discovered that that talk appeared in poems. Conversations at our schoolhouse in Vermont, long evenings of conversation. And then later, a new poem would be published, and there would be lines you'd swear you heard before.
One of the big ideas that preoccupied Frost was religion, but scholars have puzzled for decades over Frost's own religious beliefs. Jonathan Reichert's father was a rabbi, and among the documents in Reichert's collection is a sermon that Frost delivered at a synagogue.
We ask Reichert to read a short passage from that sermon.
Now, religion always seems to me to come around to something beyond wisdom. It is the straining of the spirit forward to a wisdom beyond wisdom.
Those are Frost's words, though ultimately this sermon says little about the poet's own faith, but Reichert says that's the way Frost would have wanted it.
Frost liked to play with you. He liked to leave mysteries. He did not like to spell. I mean, that's what a poet is. A poet doesn't lay out. A poet gives you a metaphor and lets you wrestle with it.
Miles to go before I sleep. Jonathan Reichert on his friendship with the poet Robert Frost, who died 50 years ago today. Children's book illustrators may not have gotten a lot of sleep last night because they know one of the grand prizes of children's literature, the Caldecott Award, will be announced this morning at the annual meeting of the American Library Association. NPR's Lynn Neary reports this year is the 75th anniversary of the Caldecott Medal. It's given to the most distinguished children's picture book of the year.
Picture books are a brilliant way to connect with children, even before they're able to speak. They continue to feed the imagination as a child grows older. And for those who are on the cusp of reading,
they give children a sense of pictorial possibility, a way to imagine words that they might not imagine on their own.
Rita Auerbach is a retired children's librarian who was chair of the 2010 Caldecott Award Committee. Over its 75 years, the Caldecott Medal has been given to a long list of children's books, from Make Way for the Ducklings and Madeline's Rescue to Where the Wild Things Are and The Invention of Hugo Cabré. Auerbach says winning the Caldecott is a very big deal for the creators of these books.
It's a little bit like winning the Nobel Prize in that forever afterwards you are the Caldecott-winning illustrator. That phrase accompanies your name wherever your name appears, and that's a quite wonderful thing.
As important as the honorific may be, the Caldecott has another advantage. It has a big impact on sales, more so than most literary awards. Chris Van Allsburg remembers the first time he really thought he had a chance of winning with Jumanji.
I always believe that you can curse your possible good fortune by anticipating it. So a much better mindset is to tell yourself that you couldn't possibly get it, but on some level believe that it might still happen. So that's a hard place to get to mentally, but I'm capable of doing it.
Van Allsburg won a second Caldecott for The Polar Express, which has become a beloved children's classic, especially popular around Christmas.
Years ago, I signed it for parents giving it to their children, and their children have subsequently become parents themselves. So now I'm signing it for, you know, for that generation. So that's a terrific feeling.
Kevin Hankus has created a series of books about whimsical little kids who just happen to be mice. Chrysanthemum, Sheila Ray the Brave, and perhaps most famously, Lily, of Lily's Purple Plastic Purse. So it was somewhat ironic that he won his Caldecott for Kitten's First Full Moon, a book about the natural enemy of mice.
It is funny. I think the bulk of my work, the thing that I'm most well known for, are the mouse books. But I'll take it.
Like Van Allsburg, Hankus writes as well as illustrates his books. He says he loves the way words and pictures can play against one another.
When it's done right, it can be so beautiful. And I think when it's done right and you see those words and those pictures together, those particular words and those particular pictures, once you see them, you can't separate them anymore because they really become one.
Both Hankus and Van Allsburg say they're happy their books have helped young children learn to read. Van Allsburg, who started as a sculptor, says he never expected to get fan mail from teachers.
They say, you know, Mr. Van Allsburg, your books have a kind of like a challenge and a puzzle and a mystery to them that seem to stimulate the desire for the kids to read. And they've been enormously helpful in getting kids who are reluctant readers to become enthusiastic readers. I think that's just naturally what will happen if you've got a great story and it's got some great pictures along with it.
And there's a good chance that kids will be learning to read with those Caldecott Award-winning books for many years to come. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.